when eventually history is written with regard to all that has been going on in the country of Ukraine over the past few weeks, undoubtedly the President Zelensky will go down in history as a man who led the people and who tried to enthuse them as best he could against the onslaught of the Russian army. In respect of our own land, many years ago, when Winston Churchill led the nation during the Second World War, there was a book written about his leadership of some 300 pages. And only three of those pages was devoted to his death. When we look together at the New Testament, and particularly the Gospel of Matthew and of Luke, we see that a third of the writings with regard to the life of Jesus Christ is devoted to his death. And as a result of that, we can learn much about why Jesus Christ really came into the world. Because Christians, strange as it may seem, celebrate his death. Mormons, for example, do not celebrate the death of Joseph Smith, nor do Muslims celebrate the death of Muhammad. But amazingly, Christians celebrate the death of Jesus Christ on the cross, which in itself was a symbol of shame and of crime and of punishment. What was it the Apostle Paul said? "May I never boast except in the cross of the Lord Jesus Christ." And when we think of it, the cross is undoubtedly the Christian symbol. If we wanted a physical symbol, it's the cross. We didn't choose to have the manger as a symbol focusing on the birth of Jesus. We didn't choose even an empty tomb recognizing his resurrection. We didn't choose a book that may be symbolical of his teaching, nor a lamp that he was the light in a dark world, but the hill of Calvary and the cross on the hill of Calvary became the symbol of the Christian church, because on the cross became the battleground where the great assault between good and evil, between God and Satan, took place. And I suppose over these next few weeks we'll be looking together at various services at the events that led to, first of all, the crucifixion and ultimately the resurrection of Jesus that we celebrate on Easter morning. But as we look at one of these, approaches to that particular time of the year, I want us to look just at simply at one verse in the scriptures this morning, which we read from Luke's Gospel, chapter 9. And the verse is simply this: "When the day drew near for him to be taken up, Jesus resolutely set his face to go to Jerusalem." That verse has what we might call a certain strange authority behind it. The time had come. Jesus had been involved in his public ministry with his disciples. They'd been doing all sorts of things. But then there came this moment in his life when he said, "Now is my time. Now is my time to go up to Jerusalem," and recognizing what was going to happen when he went there. And for a few moments this morning, I want us to ask the question, why did Jesus Christ set his face resolutely to go to Jerusalem? And the first answer to that question is surely to fulfill the prophecies of the Old Testament. Isaiah chapter 53, of which we read a part this morning, is a very remarkable chapter in the Bible. Written some 700 years before the birth of Jesus, it gives great detail about the life of Jesus. Let me give you a few examples of what it says. In verse 2, it reminds us that he had no form or majesty or beauty that we should desire him. Did you ever think about it? The Bible never gives any physical description of what Jesus looked like, or makes no comment, really, about his appearance. There are other characters in the Bible, and their appearance is commented in some sort of a way. Take, for example, Moses. When Moses was born and he was put into a basket, how was it the Bible described Moses? They described Moses as a goodly child. That really meant that he looked well. He was beautiful. Now, of course, we all say that all babies are beautiful, but the Bible specifically states that Moses was a beautiful child. Or take, for example, Daniel, the young man who was taken captive by the Babylonians and who, in the court of Nebuchadnezzar, was personally chosen in order that he would learn the Babylonian culture and he would be a role model to other young people, both with the people of Israel and also as far as the Babylonians was concerned. What does it say about Daniel? In the choice of Daniel, he was to be chosen because he was handsome, because he had no physical defect. So there are people in the Bible, and while we don't have a complete description of them, we recognize something about them. But in Jesus, we discover that there's nothing said about his appearance. In verse 3, we read that he was despised and rejected of men. From the cradle to the grave, Jesus Christ was rejected. Remember, at the cradle, he was rejected by Herod. Throughout his ministry, he was rejected by the Pharisees. Throughout the last week of his life, he was rejected by Pilate, by the crowd. He was crucified on the cross. Verse 5 tells us that he was wounded for our transgressions, that his death was a substitutory atonement. It wasn't because he had done anything wrong himself, but he was wounded for the other people. He died as a substitute. But two of the things that I find quite remarkable are found in verse 9. Remember, this was 700 years before the birth of Jesus Christ, that he made his grave with the wicked. What does that mean? That means that when whoever was going to die, he would die with the wicked. And Jesus was crucified on a center cross, and two thieves were crucified, one on either side. He died with the wicked. And the verse continues, and with the rich in his death. What does that mean? Well, Jesus, who was a pauper all his life, who had virtually nothing, what happened to him? We're told that he was buried with the rich. He was buried in the grave of Joseph of Arimathea, a man who, for a period of time, was an honorable man, a rich man, a counselor, a secret disciple like Nicodemus, but who eventually, after the death of Jesus Christ, went to Pilate and pleaded for the body of Jesus. So here, right at the beginning, Jesus would have been self-aware of the fact that he was fulfilling prophecy as he set his face to go to Jerusalem. But the second reason why he set his face to go to Jerusalem was in order to fulfill the promise of salvation. Jesus knew when he would go to Jerusalem on that last occasion that there would be a train of events that would happen. He would spend the Last Supper with his disciples. He would feel the weight of the teachers who hated him, of the traitor who betrayed him, of the friend who denied him, of the judge who convicted him, of the crowd who said, "Crucify him," of the thieves who died with him, as well as the appreciation he would have had of the friends who stood in great sympathy for him at the foot of the cross. And also, he would have been aware that on the cross certain things would happen, that he would call out those who had been involved in his crucifixion, that they would be forgiven. "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." He would have known that he would be meeting a thief on the cross, who he would say of him, "Today you will be with me in paradise." He would have recognized that there would be a time when the Father would turn his face upon his only beloved Son for the first time in all eternity, and he would say, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" He would know that he was going to be thirsty as he languished in pain and agony on the cross. He would have recognized that he was going to call out, "It is finished." Recognizing not, "I am finished," but "It is," the work that he came to accomplish. And that there would be a point come when he would gasp his last dying breath and he would say, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." And so as Jesus set out to go to Jerusalem, he would have realized all of this. But he also would have realized why it was necessary. Because the story of the last week of the life of Jesus Christ is a story that is stark, and it's bold, and it's messy, and it's full of resentment and jealousy and politics on the part of others. And what was it all about? Why was it necessary? It was necessary because you and I, the Bible says, are lawbreakers. In his teaching, Jesus summed up what God's will was for all of us, that we're to love the Lord our God with all our heart, our soul, our mind, and our strength, and our neighbor as ourselves. But also, we recognize that we haven't done this. There are those who say, you know, we're not really sinners from birth. But that's not what the Bible teaches us. We are all lawbreakers. I have two sons, they're now grown up. But when they were born, and when they started to crawl about, and when they started to do all sorts of things that young children do, they eventually had to be taught certain things. They had to be taught how to use a knife and fork. They had to be taught how to tie the laces in their shoes. They had to be taught, then when they went to school, how to add and subtract and multiply and divide and all the things that you would learn at school. But never at any stage in my life did I sit down and say to the boys, "Right, guys, what we're going to do today is we're going to have a lesson on how to do wrong. We're going to have a lesson on how to be bad-tempered, how to be jealous of your brother, how to be selfish to your brother, how to be disobedient to your parents." We never sat down and did that. Why? Because, well, we didn't want them to do those things, but there was a simple reason. We didn't need to tell them. They did it. They did it without being taught. And why was that? Because they were sinners, like all of us, by nature and by choice and by habit and even by desire. And all of us are lawbreakers. And the Bible tells us that as lawbreakers, we are condemned. A just and holy God cannot allow those who are lawbreakers and who have sin in their lives to enter into heaven. There is just no place in heaven for sin. And we read in Romans 1 and 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men." We are out of God's favor. And if heaven is a place where there's an absence of sin, steps must be taken if we're to go there to have that sin forgiven. And we can't take those steps. But only God can do that and has done it. And so as lawbreakers and as those who are condemned, we can experience the love of God. You see, the cross that Jesus Christ set his face to go to when he started off to Jerusalem, the cross itself was absolutely no accident. It happened within the plan and the purposes of God. And the cross was the reason why Jesus Christ came into the world, that it was through his crucifixion that God had planned that those who could not save themselves could find salvation. The cross was the supreme, if we could put it like this, the supreme action and display of the love of God. Because on the cross, Jesus Christ satisfied the justice of God that demanded that sin would be punished, But at the same time, he displayed the love of God, that whosoever believeth should not perish but have everlasting life. And that's why on the cross and during those hours on the cross, there was 3 hours of supernatural darkness in the middle of the day where God turned his face away from his son. And as Isaiah put it, he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities, and all we like sheep have gone astray. Jesus Christ, as he set his face to go to Jerusalem, was to enact the plan of salvation. He was fulfilling prophecy. He was fulfilling the promise of salvation. And the third thing he was doing was he was setting his face to go to Jerusalem in order to establish the church. This may come as somewhat of a surprise, but the main purpose of Jesus Christ coming into the world was not to die on the cross. The main purpose of Jesus Christ coming into the world was to establish his church, and the cross was the means to that end. What I mean by that was simply that when Jesus Christ died on the cross and people responded, then they became and do become members of the church. And that's what Jesus Christ wanted. He wanted people to be members of his church, and then as members of his church to communicate through their lives and through their lips what he had done on the cross and what the significance of the cross was for you and me. And so when we become a Christian, then we have that responsibility to pass on, as it were, to others around us the significance of Jesus Christ coming into the world, so that they will become Christians, so that they will be part of the church. That church that we speak about in the book of the Revelation, where it says will be composed of every tribe and nation and tongue and people and language, who one day will stand before the throne and worship the Lamb. I think it would be true to say that there has never been a time in the history of the world like the past few weeks that we have experienced. And there has never been a time in the history of the world where the potential for disaster has been so great. Previous generations have lived during the world wars in all sorts of difficult situations. But never has there been a time when the world has had such sophisticated technology and nuclear armaments. And there's anxiety. There's anxiety in the corridors of power, in Downing Street, in Brussels, in the White House, with NATO, even with those who are more inclined to know what's going on, even in the Kremlin. And there will be a day in the future, the Bible tells us, when the curtain of world history will fall and the world will come to an end. But that will not be determined by what's going on in Downing Street or Brussels or the White House or anywhere else. But it will be determined by the Church of Jesus Christ. There's a story told about Lord Reich. Lord Reich was a great giant of a man who was at the head of the BBC at the time of its infancy. And there were a number of young upstarts in the boardroom with him one day who didn't share his very passionate Christian beliefs. And they started to poke fun at his beliefs and said it's high time that the Church of Jesus Christ gave itself a decent burial. And Lord Reith, who physically was a great giant of a man, stood up to the full stature of his height and looked at the young man who had said what he had said. And he said, "Young man, I want to say something to you. I want to say to you that the Church of Jesus Christ will stand at the grave of the BBC It will stand at the grave of every organization and institution and community known by man, because it is within the Church of Jesus Christ that God's purposes for the world will be fulfilled. And when the last sinner for whom Jesus Christ died is saved, then the end of the world will be accomplished. The curtain of world history will fall as Jesus Christ returns in power and glory. And when Jesus Christ went to the cross, Jesus Christ realized that he was going to the cross in order to, as it were, fulfill prophecy, to effect salvation, but to establish his church that would be left in the world in order to communicate the good news of his love and his grace. And the question we need to ask ourselves this morning is simply the question, am I part of that church? I'm not asking the question, are you part of Le Comfort Presbyterian Church? I'm asking the question, are you part of the Church of Jesus Christ? Because if we are, then it doesn't matter what's going on in the world around us. We will know that our salvation and our security ultimately is secure. Many years ago, in one of the older hymn books, there was a hymn which I remember noting, although I must say I very rarely sung it, even throughout my ministry. But it was a hymn entitled, A Debtor to Mercy Alone. And the last verse of that hymn says something that is so vitally important for us to understand. And the verse says this, my name on the palm of his hands, eternity will not erase. Impressed on his heart it remains in marks of indelible grace. And then it goes on to say this, yes, I to the end will endure, so long as the earnest is given. And then two lines which I think, as far as the English language are concerned, outside of the Bible, have probably greater truth than nearly anything else. It says this, more happy, but not more secure, the glorified spirits in heaven. In other words, people who have died and have gone to heaven, they are more happy than those of us who are on earth. But they're not any more secure, because when we respond to the gospel and when we endure to the end, then we have that same security as the glorified spirits in heaven who are experiencing it, who are, yes, more happy, but not any more secure. And the question we need to ask ourselves this morning, are we secure in the knowledge that what Jesus Christ did on the cross has been appropriated for us in our lives, that we're safe in the arms of Jesus, and it doesn't matter what happens, that nothing is able to separate us from his love? That's why Jesus resolutely set his face to go to Jerusalem. Let us pray.